so.
Okay, folks, we want to try to keep on schedule here. So if you'll turn in your notebooks, you've got another outline for this session plus three other sheets that we'll be including in this session. The first strategy that we would offer for not only surviving but thriving is to believe your own gospel. To believe the gospel that you teach and proclaim to other people within your care. Often you have to remind them that God's grace is sufficient for them. One of the things that we have experienced is that the most conscientious and most responsible church leaders tend to believe that God's grace is sufficient for everybody else, but not for them. I remember reading a conversation from the wife of a former Baptist minister who he and his wife, this woman that was writing, experienced the loss of a child from leukemia at age 11. Later after that, as often happens when a couple loses a child to illness, they divorced. And this Baptist minister became an Episcopalian minister. One of the things that his former wife said about him was, she said he never believed the gospel that he preached to everybody else. I think that is a major problem. And I think that if you read Paul, especially in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 1 through 10, he said that he was not perfect. He had a thorn in the flesh. He prayed hard, and he prayed multiple times. And the answer was that I'm not going to take the thorn away, but I'm going to give you the grace to live with the thorn. And I think for us, I think it's important that we recognize that even though we're leaders, we will not be perfect. The best we can be is redeemed. And that's exactly, I think, at the center of our leadership, is to model to other people what a redeemed person looks like, and to model to other people how to live with the thorns by the power and the mercy of God when we don't have the power to fix it. That, to me, is something that we have to believe and live before our people.
The First John passage about when our hearts condemn us, God's greater than our hearts, and He knows everything.
First John chapter 3.
Yes, that's what I was saying. To me, that passage speaks so strongly because God, He knows the good things about us, and He has more grace for us than we have for ourselves. And I like that passage.
The next strategy has to do with emotional intelligence, to constantly be working on our emotional intelligence. There is an additional sheet that talks about emotional intelligence. Maybe this sounds like something kind of strange to be talking about when it comes to leadership. But I think if you'll look at a wide sample of the literature about leadership today, one of the things that sets great leaders apart from good ones is that they have a high level of emotional intelligence. Otherwise, we would call it maturity. If you look at that sheet, there's two primary parts, or domains, it calls it, of emotional intelligence. One has to do with our own awareness of ourselves and the extent to which we are in touch with and are able to manage well our own self and especially our emotions. The second domain has to do with our social awareness and our ability to manage well our interpersonal relationship interactions. There is a man by the name of Howard Gardner from Harvard who has written about multiple intelligences. And my understanding is he's working on the 10th one. He's already identified 9, but he's working on the 10th, and the 10th one he's going to call spiritual intelligence. His point is that we ask the wrong question when we ask the question, how smart are you? He says the better question is to ask, how are you smart? And one of the things about leaders is that we will never be more effective than our level of maturity. And the level of effectiveness that we have in managing ourselves and managing our relationships with other people at a higher level of maturity. That's something that I think we have to continually work on, and it's something that we can work on. It will take some coaching to do that. We'll have to have some help from some other people, because one of the things we've learned about effective leadership is leaders will only be able to receive help or coaching that would help them to function at a better level from outside the system. They'll need to have somebody outside the context in which they serve, who can coach them and mentor them so that they can then function more effectively as leaders in their context. I think that's one of the things we can do, because leadership is lonely, especially when it's mature leadership. And so we're going to need to be looking for some assistance at dealing with the loneliness. But we'll have to find that somewhere else, and we'll talk about ways of or components of doing that a little bit later.
The next on our list was the quote that we came up with: remember that happiness is the difference between what you expect and what you get. And when Charlie and I were talking about what we wanted to say to you all today, that's one of the things that that kept coming up, is that, you know, if you disillusioned people are people that are living in an illusion. If you expect something and you've told yourself something is going to be a certain way, and when it's not that way, then you're disillusioned. And I know so often when we're visiting with and ministering to ministers and their wives, ministers and spouses that have been hurt in church work. Imagine that happening. A lot of it is that they're just so naive. And I guess as you get at this point, I don't want to be cynical or crusty or whatever the word is, but there's just certain things that you just come not to expect. And if it does happen, then you're blissfully happy because you think, wow, that happened. But your expectations are so important between in the happiness that you feel. Now, let's get the word happiness out there. I think some people feel like they have this right to happiness. First of all, let me just say, I don't think God calls us to be happy. He calls us to be faithful. And that's what our calling is. But sometimes life is really good, and we feel really good about it. And that's okay, too. I think we have a setup in our culture about the happily ever after. And I don't care what my children do. I just want them to be happy, or that kind of thing. And the if only thinking, if only this would happen. There again, I think that's some of the negative thinking that hurts us when we're dealing in relationships. One secular person that I read a lot and visit with a lot, who teaches counseling workshops, has said that happiness is using your signature strengths for a noble cause for the sake of others. Sounds a little Christian in there somewhat. She wouldn't necessarily ever want to admit to that. But, I think living for others, pouring yourself out for others, and then knowing something about yourself and what your life is about, what your calling is, what excites you when you wake up in the morning and you think you're going to be doing this. What is it that you want to be doing with your life? What stretches you? What challenges you? I think you must always try to, Rick Morris said something today about how important it was for leaders to be lifelong learners. I think we all need to be lifelong learners.
Also, if you didn't hear Rick, in the last hour, the last session right before this one, he talked about a perspective from the book of Samuel, and he said that one of the things that leaders have to be prepared to do is to do the best thing for their people, even if their people hurt their feelings. And I think that's important to recognize that there is a difference between happiness and joy. You talk to a young couple that has a new baby and that we're up several hours during the middle of the night when everybody else was sleeping. Ask them if they're happy. That may not be the right question, but ask them, is it worth it? Might be the better question, because I think joy is a sense that the investment, the sacrifice, the service that we're offering is worth it.
One other thing I wanted to mention is I do think in surviving and thriving, in not just in church leadership, but kind of in life, you've got to have some people that are close to you, two or three people that keep up with you on a daily basis, that when the chips start to fall, there they are. And I just want you to think a little bit about those people that you have, and I'm prayerful for you if you don't have them, that you find them, that can be there for you, that you can count on in times of trouble and pain, or just when you want to go out and laugh and joke and have a good time. People, I think God sends us those gifts of friends, and I just want us to acknowledge how very important that is. Charles mentioned the loneliness, and that's a real dynamic. I know when we worked at the Glenwood Church for many years, we had many very dear friends within the church, but we also had some friendships outside that we could get away from, and it made it even more precious when we come back to have the support and love of those outside. You want to talk about that group?
Yeah, did you have your personal community?
Yeah.
The McDonald thing. Does that come here?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
But maybe so. I don't know.
Sorry. I was planning to talk about that.
Yeah, you were.
With the support system.
Okay, that's good. Well, yeah, but were you going to talk about the people in Tyler that helped you?
Yeah. I just wasn't going to do it here.
Oh, okay. Okay, let's just move right along. One other thing that I think happens is we get to the point where we're just overwhelmed by the needs, and they're infinite. When you're in ministry, there's something all the time, it seems, that calls you, that pulls you. And I know I at times felt like, you know, how can I possibly meet all these needs? And of course you can't. But a story that means a tremendous amount to me, and I'm sure many of you've heard the story of Mother Teresa, where when she was presented, you know, she gave her life for the dying on the streets of Calcutta, India. And when she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, a young reporter said something to her about, you know, how do you do it? There's just so many thousands of people just dying on the street that are still dying even after you've ministered to the ones that you minister to. And her famous response was, I do what I can where I am with what I have. And that's all we can do. And I think sometimes we're kind of lustful, wanting to solve all the problems of the world, when really we need to be grateful for the ministry that we do, that we can do with what we have. 5 is establish your own self-care support. Ta-da!
Okay. In your notebook, you should see a sheet that talks about your personal support or self-care system. And it has a checklist. It has a column that says, yes, I have this in place, or no, I don't. And then a final column that says, if I don't, then when am I going to? This is something that I think every church leader needs. But here's the thing. I think there are several illusions about this. One of those is there is a tendency among ministers, but I think also among elder families, to assume or to expect or to wish with wishful thinking that God or the church or friends within the church should provide this for us. I think that is false. I think that is unhealthy. I think that is inappropriate and unrealistic. When I'm talking to ministers and I'm dealing with expectations, this is one of the things that I really have to confront pretty candidly at times. Sometimes we'll have students in which the spouse in particular says, okay, we've been here 2 or 3 years, it's time for us to get out of here. The baby clock is ticking or has already sounded, meaning they may have be expecting during their last year, or they may have had a child already. And the expectation that I sense this couple having as they leave school to go into full-time ministry is that God and the elders and the minister in this couple are going to provide all of the spouse's emotional, spiritual, physical, financial, and social needs. Well, that's a great setup to be disappointed. It's also, I think, immature. And so I can cut some young people slack about that. By the time we get to be old enough to be selected to serve as elders, I would hope maybe we've worked out of some of that immaturity. Several things. It is not appropriate or realistic for those of us who lead to expect or demand that the churches that we serve care for us in the same ways or at the same level that we care for them. It is not appropriate to expect that they are responsible to take the initiative to care for us like we are to take the initiative to care for them. When a professional therapist expects the clients to take care of the therapist, that's unhealthy. It's also unethical. When doctors expect their patients to take care of them in the same ways or at the same level, in a kind of a transactional way, trade-off, that the doctor is expected and responsible to care for the patients, that's not good either. When parents expect their children to meet their needs or to care for them, at least short of the nursing home, in the same way that parents take care of the children, that's called an unhealthy family. It's called emotional incest in the literature. And I'm just saying that by definition, our role and our relationships as leaders within the churches where we serve will not be necessarily the same in terms of being reciprocal and two-way streets. The other thing is that I think is a myth is that somebody else can or should put in place a support system for us and that we should not have to do it ourselves or that we can't do it as well as somebody else can do it for us. I think that's false. I think nobody can do it as well as we can do it, and I think that we should not prefer or want anybody else to do it. We should prefer to do this ourselves, to be ultimately the ones responsible for putting this in place. I think that in order to do that, yes, we can have good friends within the context where we serve. But I do think that there will be a sense in which it's not equal. And I think it means that we're going to need a support system that involves some people outside the context in which we serve. Maybe it means that we network with some peers, with some other leaders who do the same kind of ministry that we do, and that perhaps we do form a network. Maybe it's only two other couples. Maybe it's networking with people through this network. Maybe it is partnering with the leadership of another congregation. There are congregations that are doing that very thing, where the leaders of one congregation and the leaders of another congregation who have a lot in common partner together. They do retreats together. There are even faculties at universities that are doing that, partnering with another faculty from another institution, and they get together intentionally and regularly because they have a lot in common that they can use to support each other mutually. What Judy was referring to a minute ago is that In our experience in Tyler, I had a group of ministers of other congregations who were churches of Christ. leaders, ministers. But I also had a group that met every Tuesday morning. After I carpooled and dropped off the kids at school, I would go to this group and would leave this group in time to get to my church for ladies' Bible class. This group had a Jewish rabbi, a Catholic priest, a Baptist, two Presbyterians, a Lutheran, and an Episcopalian. And this group was a collegial group that could help me to normalize my experience because they had similar experiences. They could be a safe place for me to talk about some of my issues, some of my questions, some of my struggles. And I didn't have to worry about it crossing boundaries and being a dual relationship. It was a healthier place. It was interesting that every year we would host in our home a holiday reception, somewhere between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we would always invite all of these other ministers from Churches of Christ and this other group that were from various congregations. It was always fascinating to me that maybe one of my fellow Church of Christ ministers would come. But every year, two or three of the other group, or more, sometimes four or five, would come. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me to have that group that provided some ministry to me. Another thing that Judy and I benefited from in those years in Tyler was we had a friend that is now retired, but he was a PhD psychologist. He was my supervisor when I was training to be a licensed counselor. We actually went to him for some marriage and family counseling for us. And he was a Mormon. But he ministered to us in some powerful ways, life-changing ways. So if you look at this structure here, nobody else can put this in place for you, and nobody else should. You can ask other people to be participants and resource people to you in this. But nobody else can be responsible for creating this but you. We'll give you some time for questions here in a little bit.
Reinforce people's power, not their weakness.
Okay, reinforce people's power, not their weakness. Edwin Friedman, the rabbi that we heard from in the first session, made the observation after doing years of consulting and training with military generals in the U.S. military, with academic presidents and deans, and with business corporate executives, and with congregations, with church leaders, that the tendency for most leaders is to spend the majority of their time and energy investing in trying to develop or trying to change the most emotionally immature, dependent, and unmotivated people in their systems. And he said that's exactly backwards of what he would recommend. that what leaders in all leadership contexts or systems should do in terms of investing the majority of their time and energy is to invest more of their time and energy in the most mature, independent, and most highly motivated members in their system. You know, the elder brother had a point that it didn't seem fair or appropriate for the father to be so invested in the prodigal if that meant that he was ignoring the elder brother. I think as church leaders, we have a tendency to say, well, highly mature and responsible people, we take for granted, they're going to be fine, they're on their own. We've got to be out looking for that one sheep and forget the 99. What we wind up doing is reinforcing the immature behaviors of a few immature people in our churches and frustrating and discouraging and losing the trust of our most motivated people. I think it's always important to help people recognize their strengths. There is a book right now that the Gallup organization has put out. The primary author is named Buckingham. And it's called Now Discover Your Strengths. They've got an internet profile to help you recognize your strengths. All of the leadership at ACU has just gone through this process. There are 35 possible strengths. They will help you identify your top five. And their whole philosophy is help people to recognize their strengths and then to maximize those strengths and to lead from those strengths and to contribute those strengths along with the strengths of other people. But don't spend most of your time helping people to identify their weaknesses and saying, now, if you want to be a really great person, you're going to have to fix this. So that's the purpose of encouraging people to develop their strengths.
And the next one is the focus on progress, not perfection, which I think ties in with what Charlie's saying is, you know, the perfectionistic thinking that some of us are, you know, hampered with is just debilitating. I mean, we're never going to be perfect. And I think I said earlier, God calls us to be faithful, not perfect. And in working with parents a lot, I've used the word courage. We want our kids to be courageous. And what do the words discouragement and encouragement have in common? The word courage. And one, to encourage people, you don't look at perfection, you look at progress and improvement and effort. And so I think sometimes we think we have to be 100%. Sometimes, you know, 70% is just fine. 80% for sure. I know a friend of mine said she finally decided she wouldn't do anything, like try anything new, unless she could just do it great. And so she decided, I'm going to learn to ski. And, of course, she fell 50 times or so in the first few days. But she said, I'm so thankful I tried that because it was so much fun. I wasn't perfect, but it was great. And I think the perfectionistic thinking stops us from doing things that we could do pretty well. Maybe not as, you know, and then we put on ourselves the shoulds and oughts. I should do this or I ought to do that. When that is just negative thinking and destructive thinking, just trying and being there. I think, learning to laugh at yourself, stay a little bit light, especially in new situations. We used to have this open house every year for our church, because there's no way you can have a whole church over, especially if you don't cook, which I don't do that much. So we would have the open house, and when I first started it, it was the most stressful. The boys would go, okay, we're going to have the open house. Stand away from mother, you know. And it would just be clean out the closets, clean out the garage, clean out the cabinets and everything. And this good friend, this counselor friend of ours said, you know, now what exactly is this open house about? Well, I want the church to know they're welcome, and I want them in my home, and they all look in your closets? Well, no. He said, it seems to me that what you want to do is open your home and your heart. So how important is it for everything to be perfect? And that's just one small example of a lot of areas where we try to be perfect when really, you know, as one friend of mine said, clean the bathroom and buy the telephone and you'll be good. So I do think to be encouraging is to see progress in people. Another thing that I wanted to share with you all, at our school we're doing this assets training where we have these 40 assets so that we can be very effective educators and teachers. And one of the most interesting characteristics of an effective teacher is that she smiles, or he smiles. I'm thinking, well, yeah, but you'd be surprised how many kids walk into a classroom and they don't get a smile, they don't get eye contact, and, you know, that's a simple thing, but it does make a difference. I know when somebody, and kids are experts, and they're going to get your eyes eventually, and they're going to see, and if you look at them and think, your pants are sagging and you're driving me nuts. You may not say it, but they'll see it. So, you know, seeing through some of the exteriors and seeing ways to encourage others is very important. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the gift, celebrate God's gift of laughter. And I think when we get so heavy and so discouraged, there's nothing like some fun times with friends to help you. I read an article about Dana Reeve, you know, Christopher Reeve's wife, one of the things that she said in that article is that that humor got them through lots of very dark times, and that they could still laugh together and they could still see the ridiculous nature of so many of the things that were happening to them. You know, it physically changes you. Laughter physically changes you. You know, the endorphins and all of those things. So, you know, it's healing. So have fun. Have some times to laugh. Not at people, with them.
Okay, in your notebook, there's another sheet about your personal community. Mm-hmm. Gordon McDonald.
Yeah, this is it, the coach, the thinker, the listener. No, that's right. This is, Charles and I attended a conference, a pastor's conference in San Diego. Tough duty, but somebody had to do it. It was in Southern California, where I grew up. And he was talking about the importance of a personal community, and that's one of the things I've included in the notebook about the coach, someone who brings out the best in you, the thinker, someone who stretches your mind, the listener, someone who will listen to your dreams, the sympathizer, someone who cries with you, the humorous, someone who laughs with you, the truth teller, someone who rebukes you and calls you to account, the partner in play, and the partner in faith. Now, these all, some of you are fortunate enough to have many of these in one person, but I think a lot of what we've said today is about this very community.
And today, in the days of email and cell phones, remember, you can have your network from a distance.
And don't stop yourself from building a support system. I think sometimes we're tempted to say, well, I don't want to be a problem to this person, or I don't want to be imposing myself. Don't stop yourself. Make the call.
One of the things about laughter and about humor is this ministry that Judy and I work in, called the Minister Support Network, that I mentioned earlier, involves having 8 couples in ministry to come to a 3-day retreat with 4 leader couples, Paul and Gladys Faulkner, David and Jeannie Ray, Eddie and Annette Sharp, and Judy and me. And it's basically, it is not therapy, it is a time of encouragement. If you need therapy, we'll arrange that, but that's not what this is for. One of the most therapeutic and encouraging things that brings more renewal is on Friday night we have preacher story time. And we just tell the funny things that have happened in our ministries. And we even say, some of them, it's okay if they're apocryphal, if they're funny. You know, you can stretch it a little bit.
Well, preacher story, what do you think?
But invariably on the evaluation sheets, we find that one of the most helpful parts of that 3 days is about that 1 hour to hour and a half that is spent in just telling stories that we have either witnessed or experienced in ministry. And I think it's important for us as leaders to remember if we can laugh about it, it's probably not going to kill us.
Okay, we have some time.
Okay, there's some time for questions, for clarification. So if you've got some, we'd be open to them. I'm really advocating all of that. That beyond your immediate congregational relationships, that you seek and cultivate leadership relationships with leaders of other congregations. That you seek relationship with other Church of Christ leaders in other cities, even. People that you went to college with, people that you've met here today, people that you meet at lectureships and workshops and conferences, or people that you arrange to have a retreat or a vacation with. And then that beyond outside Church of Christ networks, you also explore relationships with leaders in other fellowships and in other leadership contexts other than churches. They can be immensely helpful.
Separate.
Yeah. The way that couples are invited is really in one of 3 ways. Either someone in their congregation, we often have elders who recommend that a minister and spouse be invited. So they can refer to us and say, would you put them on the invitation list, and we will. We sometimes have had 2 couples from the same church at the same retreat. And basically that usually has been an accident, meaning that we invite people one time a year to come to one of 3 different retreats, and they may both pick the same one. In that case, we say to them, is it okay with each other if you're there together? If not, if that's going to be a problem in terms of your privacy, then we'll try to arrange it so that you come to separate events. If they say it's okay, then we'll probably say, well, then come on to the same one. A second way that they're invited is if I'm out doing consulting with a church and I learn about a couple or a situation, or if Eddie or Paul or David or some of the spouses, our 4 spouses, know about people, then the team may recommend them and put them on the invitation list. The other way is that a couple can just flat ask us and say, I think we could really benefit from that. Could we be placed on the invitation list? And as long as they're not needing therapy instead of encouragement, the answer is sure. You bet. All it takes is calling my office or writing me an email. Anybody else? We'll be around a few minutes. If you have other questions, we'll be glad to visit with you. But our thanks and our best wishes to you.